everyone, and welcome to another episode of Upzoned, where every week we take just one big story from the news that touches the Strong Towns conversation, and we upzone it. We talk about it in depth. I'm Kia, and I am back this week with soon-to-be author Chuck Marone. How are you doing, Chuck, the week before your pub day?
Good. The craziness is already starting to seep in. I know it's going to get crazier next week, but been doing a lot of interviews this week and a lot of fun stuff. So it's cool and exciting. And yeah, I can't wait to get back out on book tour next week too.
I'm really excited to see how that week goes. You are starting in Memphis and you're going all the way down, or rather up, to Maryland. So it's going to be quite the haul for you. You and Beau are going to get to know each other really well on that drive, I know.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have Michelle for a little bit too. We're going across Tennessee, down into Atlanta, up through North Carolina, Virginia. And then, yeah, like you said, ending in Maryland. So it'll be a crazy, what do we start off with, 10 days, 9 days straight? So yeah, it's going to be nuts, but fun.
Yeah. Well, I actually have a topic today I want to talk about that is not so fun, but you had a take on it that I thought was really, really interesting. And it was fresh. It was about a topic that I hear about a lot in my social circles, but I very rarely hear a lot about in Strongtown circles. So I wanted to just talk about it. It is an article in particular that launched us into this called "Private Prisons Are a Dead-End Economic Recovery Model. Just Ask This California Town." And it is from Rural America in These Times. Chuck, you posted this one on our social feeds and you said that you agreed with it, which I had first the double take moment of, oh yeah, part of our infrastructure that we own as cities includes prisons. I forget that all the time. And second, I've never talked to Chuck about this. So tell me a little bit about how this article struck you and why it should matter to the Strong Towns movement.
Cities are always looking for revenue streams. Once you understand that, once you grasp that, then their actions make a lot more sense. I worked with cities for decades and basically was internal to a lot of these conversations. If someone walks in the door and says, hey, here's a revenue stream that you can tap into, they'll sit and listen. Like that opens their eyes. I think sometimes we make the mistake because of how we talk about government and how we talk about politics and public policy. We make the mistake of looking at government as almost like a church, you know, like this thing out there solely existing to help us do good and benefit us. And when you look at, for example, Ferguson and the appalling thing about what's gone on in Ferguson, among other things, but the one that got the most national attention is just their predatory policing. The idea that, you know, the city, in order to balance its budget, would essentially sick the police on poor people, you know, regardless of what happened to the poor people and how this impacted their lives, basically squeeze in almost like a racketeering kind of way, an extortion kind of way, as much money as they could out of their populace, specifically those who could not defend themselves. And we're appalled by this. We're like, how could this happen? Government's supposed to be a force of good. But yeah, I get that part of it. But they also respond to incentives, just like a business, just like really any entity does. We at Strong Towns have to be very careful and specific about where we accept money and where we try to create partnerships, because we understand that it has a distorting effect. We've intentionally chosen this membership model because we wanted our message to stay authentic to a broad population, not, you know, the wills of like one or two foundations. So when I saw this, I'm like, yeah, I've seen this many, many times. A city wants revenue. Someone walks in the door, whether it is like in my county here, which is a poorer rural county. We offer services to surrounding counties to essentially impound or house their people in detention. So we contract out and they pay us, and we built this big oversized facility in order to do that. There's another government south of us, another big county, that is building a second detention facility and signing, I want to say, like a 20 or 30 year contract with the federal government to house immigration. People are being detained for immigration reasons. Their big sales pitch internally is that we're going to run a profit on this. you know, we're going to build this big facility and it costs so much. And then we will, in a sense, have extra money to build roads, to fund police and fire protection, to provide basic public services. And so the trade-off for the community, in a sense, is you tap into this outside source of revenue, and that outside source of revenue can be used to offset your taxes and basically pay for things that you otherwise want. The private model, the one in this thing, is just a slight variation on that, because for political reasons, for, you know, public policy reasons, pushback, these cities now in California are finding it not very cool to be in this game. They're getting a lot of criticism. So what they've done is they've essentially just sold it or outsourced it to the private sector. And now instead of getting the revenue directly, you get it through property tax. You get it through, you know, the fact that these places are worth hundreds of millions of dollars and they're not subject to Prop 13 constraints and all those things that keep property taxes where they are. So you just have a really nice, happy revenue stream. And if you're a small town or a rural area, this may be your largest, I mean, this will be your largest taxpayer. I realize that you found this novel, and I find that novel because, like, this is, we can overlay all kind of sinister motives on this, and I get it, but this is really just a matter of, we're going to pay you to do this, and the cities and the community saying, we want that money, therefore we will do this.
I find it novel only insofar as I'm trying to think back to when I first found Strong Towns, and honestly, some conversations I still have with Strong Towns newcomers about what we mean when we say cities are always looking for revenue streams. Folks come to me all the time and say, Kia, you're saying in like the Strong Towns mission, I'm so confused that like streets are a platform for creating wealth. What do you mean? Unless a street is a toll road, it's not directly supposed to create any kind of revenue for a city at all. It's not a source of income. Our sources of incomes are things like our airports, our prisons, our things like that. And we subvert that and complicate that sort of like layman's notion all the time in Strong Towns in a way that I think is very beautifully done. And I'm very proud of it. And I don't need to recapitulate it in this podcast. But what it means is that sometimes we don't talk about those more traditional straight ahead revenue streams, such as the prison complexes that are in the middle of, in my case, my near downtown in St. Louis. That's where our prison is. I'm just so curious how people who are new to the Strong Towns message might be brought in by this kind of an example, because it is a bad deal for cities, even when you are getting dollars in the door, right?
Yeah, totally. Let me, as you're describing this and the newbie, this analogy popped into my head, and I'm the king of bad analogies. So this one's completely off the cuff, but let's try it. So if you're running a grocery store, you would say that the aisles that you've created are basically the platform for selling your product. The shelving and the aisles, this is where you store your product. This is where, and so what you do is you put your effort into making sure the shelves are faced, making sure that things are laid out in a generally appealing way. You put certain things on end caps and certain things in the aisles. And this is all designed to, in a sense, maximize the amount of product that you can move through that store to build the wealth. That's what the aisles do. To me, cities completely ignore that. They're like, the aisles are just there for you to get around. And they don't think about what's on the shelves or how it's presented or how it's laid out or how it interacts. And the prison is like the guy who comes to the grocery store owner and says, you know, hey, we will buy your pallets or your cardboard in the back. And you're like, oh my gosh, a revenue stream. And so you just divert all your time and energy away from selling stuff in the aisles. You're like, don't care about that, whatever. People have to come and walk through the store. Like, I'm not worried about that. It's a fixed revenue stream. Who cares? And you focus all your energy on selling the cardboard boxes or the pallets to the guy out the back. That's essentially what cities are doing. They're like chasing after the odd little side hustle and making that like their primary thing. And this gets them into trouble for a variety of reasons. The first one is that they take their eye off the ball. They take their eye off what the shelves are and the stuff you're trying to do, building wealth in that community and all the skills and strategies that go along with doing that. They just fall away. They're just not part of the conversation. The other thing is they overextend themselves as a result of this. If, you know, the grocery store owner, if you come in and we're going to pay you this premium for the pallets and premium for the cardboard, and then you take that money and you use it to, I don't know, double the size of your store, or do something crazy thing, and then that cardboard revenue goes away. Now you've got this whole big thing to maintain, and you don't have that revenue stream. You've kind of become fragile in a sense to this one big player. We see this in the private prison game all the time. We see this in the public prison game all the time. So you fragilize in a sense your revenue stream by focusing it all on this one big player. At the end of the day, you're creating a revenue model, a way of running your community financially that is not aligned with the overall prosperity of your community. I mentioned, you know, Strong Towns earlier, and we have this membership model, and the membership model has forced us to grow slower than we otherwise would. If we were out structuring ourselves to get large grants and large foundations, we're actually at a point now where we could do that. We've kind of chosen intentionally not to, because we think that the growth that's more aligned with our membership is better for our movement and better for what we're trying to accomplish. I think cities have the same thing. When they align their revenue stream with the prison, all of a sudden you're responsive to a prison. When you align your revenue stream with what is actually good for and produces good outcomes for the people in your community, yes, it means slower growth, but it also means a more stable place and one that's ultimately going to be more prosperous. I think that's what is missing that I would say to the newbies when they walk in the door, is that you're looking at a model derived around these revenue streams as opposed to derived around humans.
I think that's a really good metaphor, actually, though I might replace the pallet guy, because I have no idea what you're talking about with that, to like maybe like a Redbox machine in front of the grocery store that gives you like a rental
same
fee.
Kind of thing.
Same kind of concept. Yeah. And you know, it's reflected in this article in the description of, we haven't even mentioned the specific city that they take as their kind of object lesson, Adelanto, California. They talk about how they delayed the opening of the city's first high school because it went $3.4 million over budget, but they finished building a prison center that went $25.4 million over budget. So if that isn't like a strong statement of a city's priorities, I don't know what is. So let's talk a little bit about the kind of elephant in the room here, which is that we haven't mentioned that these prisons, by the way, private prisons, I don't know what everyone's political affiliation is listening, but some people are struggling probably a little bit with saying private prisons are terrible, or they're saying private prisons are the only model that are going to work for our cities and towns. What do you think the better model is specifically for prisons if they want to be a strong town?
That's a really good question. And I can't say that I've thought about it a ton. In general, I'm a really strong believer in two things when it comes to local government. The first one is that if there's something that can be done profitably, running a sewer system, for example, is something that needs to be done at a profit. The city should be doing that using, in a sense, business principles to run decisions on behalf of their shareholders, which are the residents and the people in the community. Now, the interesting kind of symbiotic relationship there is that your board members, your shareholders are also your customers, but you have this kind of fiduciary responsibility to them, not to maximize profit, not to squeeze every bit of profit you can out of them, but to run this utility, this entity, in a way that makes a profit, is responsive to business and market feedback conditions, and provides the best service at the most reasonable price. That is a duty of government that we downplay and often take either one side or the other, either the side of the customer, where you're supposed to get the service as cheap as you can and forget, you know, the shareholders. Or we take the role of the shareholders, which is, you know, screw the customer over and get as much out of them as you can. When in the reality, in a city, you're both your shareholder and customer. So I think, you know, keeping those both at the center of what we're doing is important. I also think it's really critical that when we collectively agree to do things, that we actually take responsibility for doing that. It doesn't offend me that we hire, you know, someone to mow the park who's not a city employee, or we hire like a contract service to fix our potholes, or in the case of here in Minnesota, a contractor to go plow the street or the city parking lots. Sometimes that makes a lot of sense. And certainly when we're talking about like snow plowing, it makes a ton of sense. If the city is going to have a plow that's going to sit there for 6 months out of the year, 7 months out of the year, not be used, but if it were a private contractor, they would repurpose that for, I don't know, hauling asphalt around or doing something else. It's absurd for the city to spend that money and have that. So privatization in that sense makes a clear amount of sense. I start to balk at it when it's these fundamental things where it creates these kind of negative feedback loops. Prisons and jails are one. All of a sudden now, we have a private market incentive to increase the number of criminals we have. I think if we look at our community as shareholders, that is an incentive that's not in our interest. It is in our interest to deal with crime, and it is in our interest to get deviants, in a sense, out of society and have them be rehabilitated or have some period of, you know, timeout period before they're entered back in. But the idea that there would be a financial incentive underlying that to increase the number of us that are, in a sense, turned over to that, to me, creates a feedback loop that you don't want to have in your city. You don't want to create systems like that. I'm reflexively not against privatization, and I think it has a lot of roles that are important. This one has always bothered me because it seems to run counter to our best interests as a community.
Well, thank you for wading into some really tricky territory. I know that we're not going to settle this issue in one podcast, and I want to hear what you have to think if you are someone who thinks about, you know, the economic value of prisons within our cities, in the positive or the negative. We want to hear from you. You can always email us at team@strongtowns.org. Unless you have any final thoughts, Chuck, I want to go to the down zone. Are you ready to tell me a little bit about what you've been enjoying in your last week before you're a published author?
Absolutely. I got into this book, and I don't even know how I found it, but it came out in May. It's called Furious Hours: Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. It sounded like when I read the title that it was about Harper Lee on trial. It's not. It's about Harper Lee reporting on a trial. It was a great book. I loved it. But I think the thing that really kind of tugged at me was it got a lot into Harper Lee's struggles with writing. She wrote the one great book, To Kill a Mockingbird, and she really struggled to do, I mean, she actually didn't do anything after that became public. And just how that weighed on her and was this kind of turmoil. And maybe it's the fact that I have this book coming out next week and we're actually thinking about what comes next and all these other things. I've always found myself intrigued with Harper Lee, and I found myself very much empathizing with her in what was a great, really, you know, quick read. It was a very good book.
Yeah, I love Harper Lee, and I actually have been putting off reading Ghosts at a Watchman, her posthumous follow-up that they sort of Frankenstein together from various drafts, because I've heard so much about her life, and I've been thinking a lot about the issue of, like, what do you do with a writer's wishes, especially when they struggle in their process? So that's one I'm going to add to my list.
Here's the funny thing. I have not read Ghosts at a Watchman. My wife did, and she had very mixed reaction to it. In going through Furious Hours, they explained that she wrote Ghosts at a Watchman first and then started writing Mockingbird, and they basically like morphed together, and she wound up pulling out the Mockingbird stuff and finishing that. So Ghosts at a Watchman was actually written first, and because of that, some of the characters that you have kind of grown to love, specifically Atticus, is depicted in a very different way. He's not presented as heroic. Yeah, she wanted it buried. She like had it in a safe and didn't release it till the very last days of her life when it wasn't clear that she was making all the decisions.
Well, that's a bummer. Here's another one. I have a submission to the Down Zone this week that's a little wacky, but I just watched a documentary that I thought was really strange and really cool. It is called The Raft, and it is about a late an early 1970s experiment, where basically there was a Mexican social psychologist who was studying aggression. And he got this idea in his head that he wanted to put a carefully selected group of 11 people on a raft in Spain and send them on that raft, which had no motor, just a sail, all the way across the ocean over the course of 3 months, specifically to study how they got into and resolved conflict together. God knows why he thought a raft was the way to do this.
Wow.
As opposed to anything wow. else, but he actually did this very famously. And it is extremely weird, extremely strange, kind of like a reality show way before reality shows, but it reveals over the course of it sort of like the limits of human, like not just patience between the individuals, because they do fight a little bit, but mostly the limits of human experimentation, because the person who has the most aggression on the whole raft is the scientist. He is constantly trying to provoke people to fulfill the terms of this experiment. He thought keeping all of these people in like a tiny little raft with a sail and like very few amenities would be a recipe for them to get into emotional or even physical altercations. And when it doesn't happen, he doesn't know what to do. And what he does do over the course of those 3 months is really, really fascinating. And it's a cool documentary that they filmed in an interesting way many years after the experiment was done. So check it out if you can hunt it down. It's called The Raft.
It sounds like a nightmare we could try for our staff retreat maybe nope. sometime.
Nope, never. Absolutely refuse. I'm so afraid of drowning. No way. All right. Well, that is what we've got for you this week. Thank you so much for listening into Upzoned. You still have a couple of days to pre-order Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity by this other dope over here on the podcast. And then the next time we talk to you, it will be out and another host will be on because Chuck will be on the road. But you will be hearing an episode of Upzoned next week between Chuck and I in a little bit of an unusual time slot because I'm going to be talking to him about the chapters of the book. So keep an eye out for that and keep doing what you can to build a strong town. I'm getting so excited. I'm losing my words. Take care, everybody.
Take care.
Bye.